you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. That song, key to the first film that we're going to review this week with critics Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor and Wade Major of Synagogues.com. The film is the documentary The Greatest Night in Pop. It takes us back to January 25th, 1985, when that recording you just heard was made. Dozens of the biggest names in music convening at a Los Angeles studio to record that fundraising song. The documentary The Greatest Night in Pop is streaming on Netflix starting next Thursday, and Wade begins. Wade, what did you think of the doc?
It's terrific. And again, I am biased because I remember when these songs came out. It came right on the heels of Bob Geldof putting together Do They Know It's Christmas with all the British talent, right? So this was the American answer to that. And Lionel Richie still with us, thank goodness, because he co-wrote the song with Michael Jackson. So he walks us through the entire process of how the song came together and how it was butted up to the American Music Awards, which he was also hosting, where he also won a ton of awards, and the incredible stress and chaos of herding all of this talent into one room at one time. And the song is so good and so memorable and so extraordinary that you know, we take it for granted. Oh, you bring a bunch of professionals in a room and it happens. No, they had to decide who's going to do the solos and who, and there's even a walkout, and I won't spoil it for anybody, but there is a legendary talent who just said, I'm done with this, and,
really?
And left. And they kind of laugh about it in hindsight because it really was incredibly tense. But the high point for me was hearing the engineer talk about, and they have footage of it, when Michael Jackson laid down some of his initial tracks. And you see it and you hear it. And he talks about just how extraordinary it was to hear that voice in the studio. And you have the same reaction watching this film.
One of the things I love about the recording is the solos in the song. You hear how they're really pushing themselves because
they're
in a sense competing against their peers. And so you hear some of the great vocal lines that these artists have done in this song. Peter, what did you think of The Greatest Night in Pop?
Yeah, it's terrific. You know, the song for me is one of the great earworms.
It is. I think it was designed to be there.
Yeah, exactly. But what's interesting is how, you know, they talk about the process of how the song was created and how everything was put together, and all these great artists in the single studio. With, you know, Quincy Jones, who coordinated the whole thing, had a sign over the entryway, so, you know, check your ego at the door.
Right.
But all of the stuff that they talk about, we actually see footage of. We see Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson, you know, working out a collaboration. We see all the artists, you know, rehearsing their one, you know, lyric. And it's almost as if they knew there was going to be a film eventually made of this. And they have incredible amount of footage.
It's astonishing we haven't seen it yet, that it has taken all these decades for us to finally see all this footage. It's
I have
amazing.
Seen some clips over the years, but nothing that gives you the full
scope.
No,
it's all together. But the funny thing is that they show you all of different artists who are very nervous in some cases, like Huey Lewis and Cyndi Lauper, you know, I mean, because they know they really got to knock it out of the park, you know, and then they get to Bob Dylan, who doesn't quite fit in, you know, and he's trying to do, you know, just, and we did, you and me. You know, it's very funny. You know, and Springsteen, who is among the people who they interview contemporarily, is really sharp about the whole process and what happened and what was good and bad and all the ins and outs. He's really sort of your spirit guide to the sanity of what was going on there.
It sounds so entertaining.
It is.
Yeah.
We're talking about the documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop. We Are the World's recording at the historic A&M, now Henson Studios, in Hollywood. The film is unrated. It starts streaming on Netflix next Thursday, January 29th. Sometimes I Think About Dying is a romantic comedic drama starring Daisy Ridley and Dave Mirej. The film is directed by Rachel Lambert and written by Stephanie Abel Horowitz, Kevin Armento, and Katie Wright Mead. Peter, what'd you think of Sometimes I Think About Dying?
It's a terrible title for a terrific movie. You know, I don't know that you could recommend this movie, but just based on its title, I think I have other plans tonight. But it's a really, you know, Daisy Ridley, who's a wonderful actress, who's primarily known for Star Wars, but you know, hasn't had much of a great career since then with these movies that barely get released. But this one was a Sundance, pardon the expression, fave last year. And she plays this kind of very mousy, cubicle worker in Washington State or Oregon coast that, basically goes home and eats cottage cheese and does Sudoku and talks to her mother on the phone and, you know, dresses in neutral colors. And she sort of wants it this way, but she's very neutral person. But the office that she works in, it's never quite clear what her job is. This film has some of the best office workplace atmosphere I've ever seen in a film. It's so accurate to, you know, people coming in and pouring the coffee and small talk. And it's very sharply observed. And she's sort of brought out of her shell a bit by the character played by Dave Mirej, who's a wonderful comic actor, I gather. And, you know, he's a stand-up comic sometimes. And the relationship that they have is quite touching and never forced, never sentimental. I mean, the whole movie really has a wonderful... And I'll just say one more thing, that if you describe this film to people, they'll say, oh, that sounds really boring. The trick is, Stanley Kaufman once wrote a very interesting review of a Russian film. He said the trick to making, if you're going to show boring stuff on screen, the trick to not making it boring for the audience is to make the audience feel like if I too were in that situation, I would be bored, as opposed to boring
the
audience.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what this film does.
We're talking about Sometimes I Think About Dying. Wade?
So it is structured very much as a romantic comedy. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. There's nothing revolutionary about that. And it is also part of that subset, that subgenre of misfit romantic comedies, which kind of begins in 1962 with Frank and Eleanor Perry's David and Lisa, includes things like Punch Drunk Love. And there is an innate charm to that, that I think is done better here than I've seen it done in years. Because when you do them, you have to make the misfits real. You can't mock their social anxiety. You can't make them the butt of the joke. You have to make their very unique insular romance something credible. You have to make it appealing and affectionate. You have to bring the audience into their anxiety. And that's what is done so incredibly well here. Rachel Lambert does an amazing thing. She takes a play that is very theatrical, and she expands it in an incredibly cinematic way, but not on a grand canvas. Like Peter said, you feel the atmosphere of the office. I mean, the mundane chit-chat, but you don't care about it because you're so wrapped up in these characters. It's beautifully done.
Sometimes I Think About Dying's rated PG-13, starring Daisy Ridley and Dave Mirej. You can see it in a one-week run at AMC's The Grove 14 before it expands to select theaters next Friday the 2nd. The Tunisian drama Under the Fig Trees is Tunisia's entry for Academy Award consideration. The film's in Arabic, and it's directed by Arij Sahiri. What did you think, Peter, about Under the Fig Trees?
It's a terrific movie. It takes place in one day in a fig tree orchard in the summer, and the people who are working there are a cross-section of, you know, young, old, men, women, young men, young women. There's a kind of belligerent boss who's making sure that the figs are ripe and that nobody's stealing stuff. And it's sort of like a Tunisian Altman movie in a way. I mean, you've got this cross-section of people, and the director moves back and forth between, you know, this young couple, this young girl who had a crush on this kid when he was 7, and then he moved away, and now he's back picking, you know, figs with her, and he doesn't. She's still smitten, and he's kind of trying to act aloof. And there's all these wonderful stories. There's older ladies, you know, some of them are quite religious, some of them are, you know, very gossipy. There's all sorts of sexual politics going on. I mean, it just moves very smoothly throughout this community, and really gives you, without fully being aware of it, in a way, a real depth of feeling as to, you know, how these people, you know, work and the working conditions. And it's really it's a marvelous little movie.
Under the Fig Trees from Tunisia, and the director Arij Sahiri co-wrote the screenplay as well. It's unrated. It's available for viewing on demand. Also this week on Film Week, Behind the Haystacks, which is Greece's official submission for Best International Oscar. The film is written and directed by Asimina Proedrou. What did you think, Wade, of Behind the Haystacks?
Yeah, if you don't find it under the fig trees, you'll find it behind the haystacks.
the yum-yum tree.
also released by Film Movement, who seems to love movies with prepositional phrases. Behind the Haystacks is actually quite a good film, and it doesn't feel like a Greek film. It feels more like almost like a Dardenne brothers film. It has that very urgent kind of slice of life quality that you mostly find in French and Belgian cinema, Francophile cinema. It's about a guy, a fisherman, a Greek fisherman, has a very tough life, goes across the Macedonian border to sell his fish, and he's just not keeping up. He's getting buried in debt. And so he decides to become a migrant smuggler, and that has a whole cascading series of ramifications for him and his wife and their daughter, and their, you know, you wrap all of this this generational struggle up in it, and it's really quite an interesting tale, and it's a slow burn. It really it kind of worms its way under your skin, but it really pays off very bravely by the end.
We're talking about the Greek movie Behind the Haystacks. Peter, quick thought on this?
It's very good. It's structured as a sort of from three separate characters' points of view. It's not a Rashomon kind of thing because the stories all interlink in the same way, but you do get a sense of you know, really contrasting viewpoints. And it also, I think, points up a lot of the xenophobia in this community and the reaction to the Muslim immigrants. You know, there's the local priest doesn't want any outreach for the immigrants. And the wife of one of the characters is very religious and is torn between, you know, wanting to help and wanting to abide by her husband and her precepts. There's a lot going on in this movie. It reminded me in some way of the Romanian movie RMN.
Yeah.
You know, but it's quite strong.
Behind the Haystacks is unrated. It's streaming on Film Movement Plus. The South Korean action-adventure Badland Hunters is directed by Hyo Myung Hing. The film is unrated. Peter.
Well, if you saw any of the Concrete Utopia, which was the South Korean movie, this is sort of a sequel to that. There's been this apocalyptic earthquake, and people are, you know, roaming the world trying to find out, you know, where to live, where to eat, what to drink. And there's this one high rise that remains with this crazy doctor who seems like he's out of Poor Things, who, you know, is trying to create a new race in a sense. And it's kind of crazy. It's kind of exciting and kind of disposable. But I think, you know, if you liked Concrete Utopia, this film sort of extends the madness of that film.
Badland Hunters unrated, and it's streaming on Netflix. The Underdogs stars Snoop Dogg and Tika Sumpter, Mike Epps and George Lopez. Wade, what do you think of The Underdogs?
I wanted to like it so much because I like Snoop. I mean, he's, you know, he's a Laker fan. He's an L.A. local. He's a legend. And this is just so terrible. I really disliked the first half of it. I thought it was just so amateurish and shameless. I mean, it's basically the Mighty Ducks with Snoop as a washed-up football receiver who, you know, has to now coach this kid, this kind of ragtag kids team. But it owns that Mighty Ducks analogy because he's literally told at one point in the film, hey, this is just like the Mighty Ducks, and you kind of roll your eyes. And then by the end, you realize Snoop's just using this movie as a plug for his football league. So the whole thing is really just very mercenary, and it's not well done. And I just found it kind of painful, but I think I gave up in the second half and just kind of went with it because it was just too much to resist.
The Underdog, starring Snoop Dogg, directed by Charles Stone III, written by Danny Siegel and Isaac Shamus. It's rated R. The Underdogs is streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Coming up, we'll talk about Norman Jewison, the great director who died last Saturday in his late 90s, but left behind an extraordinary film legacy. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Much more to come.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Coming up later on the program, we'll talk with all three of the directors of Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Their film, of course, Oscar-nominated for Best Animated Feature. Justin K. Thompson, Kemp Powers, and Joaquin Dos Santos will all be with us in studio talking about Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. But we're so pleased to have with us, just back from Park City and the Sundance Film Festival, Justin Chang, Los Angeles Times film critic, who shared with us some of his favorites at the festival this year. Justin, thanks so much. Please start us out with Presence, which is a horror thriller directed by Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. You know, Steven Soderbergh, who won the top prize at Sundance 35 years ago for Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And even though with all his Hollywood success, he's always been still in the vanguard of independent filmmaking. Presence is a ghost story that stars Lucy Liu and Chris Sullivan as a married couple who've just moved with their two teenage children into a house that turns out to be haunted. So far so normal, or paranormal rather. What's ingenious about the movie, and this is not a spoiler, is that it's shot entirely from the ghost's perspective. I won't say more than that, except that as you'd expect from Soderbergh, the direction and the camera work are ingenious, extraordinarily clever, and the movie is both spooky, darkly funny, and in the end, it's quite devastating, too.
Mm. We're talking about the horror thriller Presence from Steven Soderbergh. David Koepp wrote the screenplay. Love Lies Bleeding, a romantic drama starring Kristen Stewart. Rose Glass directed it and co-wrote it, Justin.
Yeah, this is a very different movie from Rose Glass's horror movie, St. Maud. And I'll just say, if you see only one ultra-violent lesbian bodybuilder noir this year, you should make it this one.
This would be it, okay.
This would be it.
In that huge genre of films, yes.
The year is early, though. Let's see how it goes. But, let's just say the movie introduces Kristen Stewart unclogging a toilet and only gets nastier from there. It also stars a terrific Katie O'Brien as the aforementioned bodybuilder with whom Kristen Stewart falls in love, which sets off this chain of violence and revenge, some of which just has to be seen to be believed. This was in the festival's midnight section. It was a big hit there. It was really fun seeing it with a crowd. Extremely tense and stylish and atmospheric in a way that will remind a lot of people of Drive, with the Ryan Gosling movie from years ago. So it's very darkly funny.
And
as well.
Intense. Love Lies Bleeding from director and writer Rose Glass. Kristen Stewart stars A Real Pain, a comedic drama starring Kieran Culkin and Jesse Eisenberg. Eisenberg wrote and directed A Real Pain.
Yeah, so Eisenberg and Culkin play bickering cousins on holiday in Poland And Eisenberg in this case is sort of the calm, level-headed, straight man, while Tolkien in his first movie role post his Succession Emmy win is the gregarious but really volatile, hot-headed one who often gets them in trouble. And so it's a deceptively lighthearted buddy comedy, but with quite a bit of depth to it. And I think it's a real advance for Eisenberg as a writer-director after his previous film, When You Finished Saving the World. It's also a personal story rooted in some of his experience. And both actors are terrific. And the movie becomes kind of a meditation on pain, as the title suggests, and sort of the difference between personal pain and world historical pain as embodied by the many Holocaust memorials that the two characters and their fellow tourists are visiting. So yeah, it's a really entertaining movie. A lot of heart and a lot on its mind as well.
A Real Pain, starring Kieran Culkin, Jesse Eisenberg. A Different Man, a thriller starring Sebastian Stan and Renata Rensva. Films written and directed by Aaron Schimberg. Different Man, Justin.
Yeah, A Different Man is a hilarious and unclassifiable blend of sort of dark comedy with science fiction, some Cronenbergian body horror. Sebastian Stan gives a remarkable performance as an actor who has neurofibromatosis, a facial condition that in the movie is healed through some experimental procedure. And it's about what happens and doesn't happen when he starts going through his life looking as handsome as Sebastian Stan does. It should be said, the movie features really terrific support from Renata Reinze, who you'll remember from The Worst Person in the World. She was wonderful in that. And the real scene stealer here, though, is Adam Pearson, an actor who actually does have neurofibromatosis. And he appeared in Under the Skin, which could also be the title of this movie. It's a very playful, almost meta comedy at times, really fascinating, continually surprising, and from the writer-director Aaron Schimberg.
A Different Man. Black Box Diaries, a documentary that's directed by Shuri Ito, and it's her story as a journalist investigating her own sexual assault. Justin?
A really hard-hitting film that sheds light on how, as underreported and under-prosecuted as sexual assault is all over the world, it's been especially awful in Japan. At one point in the movie, the statistic is floated that only perhaps around 4% of such incidents are reported, let alone prosecuted. And so what's really commendable about Shiori Ito's film is that and her experience is that she herself is a journalist and a writer. She's writing a book alongside this investigation. And so it's her journalistic acumen and tenacity that empowers her to go public with her story. And so while the movie is fairly straightforward in following her investigation, her interviews with police officers, witnesses, and others as she seeks justice, her efforts to do this, there's something really extraordinary about her seeing her courage in confronting her attacker and her naysayers in the media head on.
We're talking about the documentary Black Box Diaries, all of these films being shown currently at the Sundance Film Festival, and our final film from Sundance, In the Summers, a drama that's set in New Mexico, written and directed by Alessandra Lacaraza-Samudio.
Yeah, I walked into In the Summers knowing nothing about it, which is often the best way to see a movie, of course. And it's a kind of long-term coming-of-age movie about a single father played by the Puerto Rican musician René Pérez Yoglar, who's better known as Residente, and the two kids who come to visit him each summer. And they're played by different actors over the course of the movie, which spans four different visits. And this is a movie that touches on parenting, alcoholism, neglect, queer identity, among other things. But what's really wonderful about In the Summers is it is not emphatically about any of those things. It's not an issue movie. It plays out with great subtlety and low-key realism that by the end, Larry, I don't know if it was me being at Sundance and missing my own two daughters from exposure, it just completely broke my heart. And I hope it'll be picked up and released sometime soon so that it can break everyone else's too.
Oh, that's great. In the Summers is the film from writer-director Alessandra Lacaraza-Samudio. And just in closing, Justin, we're pretty much out of time, but you think we're going to get a chance to see all of these films either in theaters or streaming?
Yes, I think so. And I'm terrible about having distributor information right at hand. I know some of these movies do have distribution. You know, Neon actually bought Presence, the Soderbergh film, out of the festival. So,
Okay.
and that's one that you should we will definitely see in theaters, and it's a great audience movie. So I'm grateful that that they picked that one up. And I hope the other ones, some of which do have distribution too, will be seen soon. So,
Justin, thank you so much. Really appreciate you sharing what you saw and what most impressed you at the Sundance Film Festival. Welcome home.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure as always, Larry.
Thank you so much. And you'll have a chance to see Justin on stage at our Film Week Academy Awards preview coming up Sunday, March 3rd at the historic Orpheum Theater in downtown Los Angeles. Justin, one of our 11 Film Week critics, will be on stage there. Now, still with us, Peter Rayner and Wade Major. We want to talk about director Norman Jewison, who died at the age of 97 last Saturday. Peter, let me start with you and just what you think is his biggest filmic legacy.
Well, he was incredibly versatile. He did everything from Doris Day comedies to Fiddler on the Roof to In the Heat of the Night. I think his legacy was just that he was so strong in ways that really mattered, with subject matter that really mattered. In the Heat of the Night, you know, is a marvelous movie. Fiddler on the Roof is one of the best musicals ever made. You know, he really was able to, and Moonstruck, of course, is a great comedy. He did all of this stuff with real panache, and he was a real actor's director. I mean, it's no accident that the performances in his films are always a cut above even what those actors normally did in other films.
Rod Steiger in The Heat of the Night.
Yeah, you know, I wrote and co-produced a documentary on Poitiers for A&E, and Jewison was a big part of that show. Also, there was a Zeitgeist documentary on the making of Fiddler on the Roof last year that really is almost like a tribute to Jewison. It's worth seeing just for he was a marvelous raconteur, and he also he started what was in effect the Canadian version of the American Film Institute. You know, he was very active in promoting young filmmakers and in you know, film culture, both in Canada and in America and Hollywood and England. You know, and I have to say, you know, personally, he was just a marvelous guy. He was just, you know, the old adage that, you know, really nice guys don't make good movies is not true in his case. I mean, he really, and I think it's because he was so perceptive about human emotion, you know, about human behavior, and that translated into the way he directed actors and the way they came across. It's something very authentic about his people, and you know, so I think, and even you know, the first film that he considered his own first film, even though it wasn't, The Cincinnati Kid, which he took over from Sam Peckinpah, who was fired. I mean, that's a marvelous movie, you know, with Edward
Very
G.
Funny.
Robinson. And, you know, I mean, he worked well with Thomas Crown Affair is just, you know, a blissful romance, thriller, spy, you know, whatever you want to call it is great.
The Russians Are Coming.
The Russians Are Coming is hilarious. You know, I mean, Alan Arkin, Eve Marie Saint, all those people in those films, you know, there's a whole, you know, pageant of wonderful performances by wonderful actors in his films.
Yeah, Wade, your thoughts of Norman Jewison?
Literally the last of a particular breed, and we could also throw Sidney Lumet and Sidney Pollack in there. They were the last of a breed of directors who could do anything, any genre, any type of film, and bring an artist's veneer to it. They could take the silliest of scripts or the most mundane of dramas and make it artful. And I spent an evening with Norman Jewison at a Skirball event, part of AFI On Screen Cinema's Legacy series about 20 some years ago. And it was amazing. I mean, he was such a genteel, kind, more interested in me for some reason than I was interested in him. And I think that speaks to the kind of filmmaker that he was. He was observational. He loved people. And we forget, he produced and directed the Judy Garland Show on television. And if you can get hold of the DVDs of that, his audio commentaries are astonishing. Astonishing.
I'm glad you mentioned live television because he, and I think this is true of Lumet also, didn't they get a lot of
live
their
television.
Experience doing
absolutely
early
the whole
live
generation?
TV?
Yeah.
John
yeah.
Frankenheimer, there were a whole bunch of directors like that, you know. But Jewison worked with, you know, Sinatra, with all the great music people. Also, I mean, his socially conscious films, you know, The Soldier Story, In the Heat of the Night, he did
Hurricane.
Yeah, about Reuben Hurricane Carter.
Yeah, I mean, he was going to do Malcolm X, and then, you know, Spike Lee stepped in, so end of story. But, I mean, that probably would have been, you know, great if he had done it as well. I mean, he was very, very aware of social aspects of film.
Norman Jewison, who died last Saturday at the age of 97. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.